Bobbish.
So next is my great pleasure to introduce Heather Miller. Actually, I am convinced there are several people who look just like you.
Really?
Yeah. So at one point you held jobs in both Switzerland and the United States. She was a founder of the Scala Center, so she's done great work with Scala. She's done work with distributed systems. She's done great work community building. She's currently a professor in Pittsburgh at Carnegie Mellon University. Yesterday we sat there and Heather was enumerating, you know, six things that she could do for a keynote. They all sounded great.
You don't know which one it is.
You mean I don't know?
What?
You mean I don't know?
I don't know.
Okay.
Do you?
We'll find out. So give Heather a warm welcome. Thank you very much.
All right. Good morning. As Mike said, my name is Heather Miller. I'm a professor, or an assistant professor in the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. And as Mike said, I co-founded the Scala Center in 2016. No longer there, of course. I did my PhD under Mark Rogerski on Scala, and I finished it in 2015. And stuff that I did related to Scala was I worked on the futures library that people use and the concurrency libraries that are in Scala. I did a lot related to type class derivation in the very beginning, like 2012 or something. So I'm sorry for my involvement in that. I've been doing lightweight type system extensions for years. Really? I'm usually pretty noisy.
I should probably turn it on, right?
Would that be smart?
That would be smart.
I don't know.
Yeah, should work.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yeah.
Better, okay. Louder, too loud.
Should I start shouting more? So I've worked on type system extensions, lightweight type system extensions related to Scala, and programming models for distributed computing. And I also worked on the MOOCs, the Coursera MOOCs. I did one about programming with Spark, and also worked on all of the functional programming MOOCs. And I joined CMU as an assistant professor in 2018, and the stuff that I do at CMU, I do a lot of random things, and I'm going to enumerate them shortly, but kind of the high-level idea is usually stuff around distributed programming, and, it could be like a language-based sort of approach, or it could be stuff related to the runtimes that we use when we want to program distributed systems. I work with several people. Two of the PhD students are there. There are other folks in my group as well that are not PhD students. You might know Chris Micklejohn. Another person that you might not know, his name is Matthew Wiedner. The stuff that we work on in our group, so I'm working with Matthew on a new kind of foundation for building CRDTs. So it's sort of like a mathematical kind of reformulation of these things. And the idea, or the goal, the reason why we're doing this is because we want to make CRDTs more composable. We want to use them like regular functional data structures if we can. And with Chris Micklejohn, lately we've been working on trying to do fault injection as a kind of testing that's done at CI time rather than shutting down random parts of your data center or modeling things in TLA+. So these are like two of the big research projects that we're working on in my group. We also do a number of other things. So we're working on a project that's all about trying to check global configurations of microservices before they're deployed. I'm working on data structures for federated machine learning, which is basically moving your machine learning training off, like, you know, job or whatever you want to call it, your optimization stuff to edge devices, basically, or smartphones, things like that. So we're working on coming up with a way to help people who are building these federated systems program these things more easily. And I actually also, it doesn't seem like it maybe, but I do projects related to open source developer communities, and I'm collaborating a lot with people at CMU who do this. And we have a project right now about how ideas spread in open source communities. So I'd really like to talk about some of these things, but that's not the topic of the keynote. As you might have noticed, it's this open source numbers I think everybody should know. So I've been collecting for a long time a lot of data about trends in open source, and you might be like, well, oops, my laptop laptop just froze. Go forward. No. Hold on. All right. Sorry. It just freaked out. So you might be like, well, all right. So if you do all this funny distributed system stuff, you do things related to functional programming and type systems, then why the heck are you talking about open source stuff? And that's because, like, you know, after making type class derivation possible as a PhD student with Eugene Bermacco, when we were like, okay, let's change the way that Scala finds or looks up implicits, and like let's design a macro system. Like we kind of worked on these things together, and that was like a really hairy problem. And then working on type systems extensions, concurrency, and things related to asynchronous computing, I agree with this guy called Jeff Bigham, who is a professor at CMU and in the School of Computer Science, and he argues that the two hardest problems in computer science are people. Convincing computer scientists that the hardest problem in computer science is people, and off by one errors. I honestly, after like poking around in things that were way too complicated, people are still far harder in my opinion. And when I ended up in charge of the Scala Center, had to shift my focus from all kinds of weird nitty gritty things that I was focusing on to things that were going on in open source Scala and what was going on with our community and how to sort of grow and make this community healthier. And I should point out that this wasn't just people who were paying into the Scala Center. I wasn't like doing this for them. I was doing this because anybody with an internet connection should be able to join like a healthy, happy community that works on and around Scala. But having to pivot from weird nitty-gritty academic stuff to community issues, there was suddenly, my focus was, okay, I don't know very much about this community thing. How do I try to do something to make it better? And so there were a lot of problems with the health of some of the projects in the core community, sort of like libraries and things that people use. And I started just trying to figure, as an academic, I'm like, well, surely somebody has thought about some of these things before. And I started digging around in research. Turns out that there's not a whole lot of research on it. There's becoming more and more research these days. In the last maybe 4 or 5 years, people are starting to do research in open source communities and communication in them and things like that. But at the time when I was just getting into the Scala Center, there wasn't a lot of research except, people sort of proclaiming that this was, a lot of the problems that I was seeing were problems all over the open source community. In other languages, whatever, like everywhere. And so back then, I started collecting data. I mean, and the data is mostly like government statistics or things that other people have written. And I have this, what I think is like a nice picture of things that I've observed, sort of exemplified in data. And I like showing people who work, who work as programmers, these data points, because I think it's a number of data points that you should just kind of have in the back of your mind day to day. It should, I hope, change your thinking about how to engage with one another and also how to, think about giving your time back to open source projects. So there are 3 points. There are 3 things that I argue are changing. First, how we build software is changing really quickly. So when we sit down to build something, whatever you want to call it, it can be an app, it can be whatever, anything. We sit down to build something, we build it way differently than we did 5 years ago. A lot of things are happening and changing in open source in the last 5-10 years that we should all just be aware of, because we think, these things are open and available to us and we can just use them. We should know a little bit about how things are evolving in open source land. And then also like what we think of a software engineer. So if you want to hire somebody to be an entry-level developer at your company, what skills do they have? So I talk fast, and I'm sorry. I can't stop that. I've tried for years. It's not going to change. So I apologize in advance, but I have a lot of the things that I'm saying as text on the slides and a lot of graphs. So hopefully that helps. But I'm going to kind of run through a number of data points in these three areas. And the first one that I'd like to get into is basically how people are getting into tech is changing. The first point worth making is I think we already know that hiring is difficult if you need to expand a team of developers at your company. You know, I know I come from the U.S. and the U.S. has its own issues with hiring, but this is actually a rather global trend. So these data points, usually these websites are all focused on U.S. companies, right? But this is nothing, you know, surprising. We see these articles all the time. And I actually went and collected some data points about Germany as well. So I actually really wish I knew the right place to look to find this for like overall all of Europe. But according to the internet, so about 8% of jobs that job postings that go up are destined specifically for developers right now in Germany. These are numbers as of May 2019, and. You know, open developer, there remain lots of open developer jobs that are unable to be filled. Just in Berlin alone, there's around 5,000 right now, or whatever, right now as of May 2019. I presume it's not super different. And, you know, if you look at things by state, there's a lot of states where a number of openings are exist that are hard to fill, basically. So I wish that I knew the right place to look to find like government projections. I don't, and I'm sorry. So I'm going to show you numbers that I have for the U.S. I know there are differences in the labor markets between the U.S. and Germany and Europe in particular. But I think that still this trend of there being an increasing need is basically the same across the U.S. The U.S. and Europe. So in the U.S. right now, I got statistics because, you know, the U.S. has lots of problems. For some reason, we're pretty good at collecting statistics about the number of people that graduate with specific degrees and the number of jobs that are currently open, as well as the projections for, you know, how many jobs are expected to have to be filled. So if you combine, the numbers from the Department of Educational Statistics and the Department of Labor Statistics, you get this interesting picture. This, for various reasons, we only have data up until 2015, because for some reason it takes the Department of Educational Statistics a bunch of years to publish these things. But this is what the recorded numbers are for people who have graduated with CS-related degrees, people who are expected to be able to go into a developer job, in blue. And these are the projected numbers from the same department in red. So this is what it looks like. So obviously there are an increasing number of people graduating with computing-related degrees. So the last available data point was that there were 60,000 people who graduated with some kind of computing-related degree in the U.S. that could go into an entry-level development job. And that, you know, the growth rate is about 7% per year. So this is the growth of people getting degrees. And you might, right now in the U.S. there are over 500,000 computing-related job openings that haven't been able to be filled. So this is, you know, just like overlaying it on top of this current graph, that's you know, more, even if I stacked up a bunch of these bars, there's not enough people to fill those positions. And even when you take into consideration these coding boot camps that are very popular, you know, in recent years, they've gotten better at sort of producing numbers for how many people have graduated from these things. And coding boot camps are growing faster than universities are. They're growing at about 14% per year, I think. But these are the projected numbers for coding boot camp graduates. And then if you listen to the Department of Labor and Statistics in the U.S., they project this, you know, on this slide, whoops, here, this 500,000 number, they project it to increase to 3.5 million. So if you overlay that on top of like the numbers I just showed you, I don't know how you're gonna like pile these bars up and fill that up. I mean, if they're actually right, this looks like a problem, right? Again, this is a US-centric view. I don't know how to get these numbers for Germany or Europe, so if anybody would like to like email me or something to tell me how I could find those numbers, I would be very grateful. But I mean, the problem still stands. I think something like 4% is like the rate of growth per year in computing, in the computing profession in Germany as well. So it's not a little bit, it's a lot. And the Department of Labor, Department of Educational Statistics estimates that only about 90% of the jobs can be filled by people who leave the U.S. or who leave U.S. or who graduate from U.S. bachelor degree granting programs. So clearly, we don't have enough people, at least in the U.S., to solve these problems. So unrelated to these fun labor statistics that are super boring, actually. You can actually also see these things in Stack Overflow numbers. So I know that this is like a little pixelated, but if you look at the developer survey results from 2017, 18, and 19 on Stack Overflow, you see a trend where you have, you know, people. So this is these are all the results from the people who are, from the question, how many years have you been coding professionally? So how many years have you been working, right? As a professional developer. And so as you can see here, in all of these graphs, the majority of people have been programming for, professionally for less than 5 years, most of them on the order of 1 or 2 years. Since these numbers are banked differently from year to year, it's kind of hard to show a really exciting, interesting trend. But if you look at things, around the sort of 5 year mark, you can say, 50% of people in 2017 have up to 5 years of experience. So basically 32% have 3 years or less. In 2018, 57% of people had up to 5 years of experience. So you can see that this number is growing. And then 41% of people in 2019, again, it's not a beautiful comparison, but still the point is that 41% of people have less than 5 years of experience. So I hope what you see here is that this number is increasing, that people are getting jobs, and most people have actually very little experience. And so the thing that I wish you to connect the dots and realize with this slide is we have a lot more newcomers in our profession, and we're going to have a lot more newcomers, in the future as well. So, especially in the U.S., there's this tidal wave of newcomers entering the profession, and it's just going to keep on picking up speed. And basically, what the Stack Overflow numbers show is that the number of years of experience of practicing software engineers is dropping overall. And so there are people publishing articles about this in the communications of the ACM, and they, this is just one of a few articles, right? But people argue, this is quoting somebody who founded a coding boot camp. They say they basically argue that new frameworks that people are using that are all open source have a tendency to basically reduce the barrier of entry to programming professions. So what this founder of this coding bootcamp says. Says new frameworks are lowering the barrier to entry. Rather than typing these 7 lines of code to get a menu to pop down, you just download this framework from a code base that allows you to do that in a simpler way. Frameworks are taking the hard work that developers pride themselves on out of the equation. Another point to mention, there's no shortage of articles like these either. Existing developers are burning out all over the place. And there are some arguments for why this is the case. So unable to fill tech vacancies, employers shuffle off additional duties to current employees, which leads to burnout and has a negative impact on local business development. Over 30% of respondents to an Indeed poll, so we all know Indeed.com, over 30% of respondents surveyed admit that this issue accelerates staff turnover. And this is a quote from the blog article in response to that poll. With companies unable to fill, it's the same one, right? Yeah, over a third of respondents were surveyed said the lack of timely hiring caused burnout. So this is the same point. This is somebody interpreting this data. You could also say, well, increased diversity will help, right? Because there are more people that we can just throw into our pot to make it to make these things better. But Another observation is, well, if we got better at immigration or if we got better at dealing with remote work, we might end up with more tech workers, right? But really, the thing that I think that we should all actually think about is that, you know, we really have to do something. We probably have to actually be better humans to those around us, and we need to probably get good at mentoring. So I want to just make a quick diversity point, because, I mean, I don't know, there's a lot of people who make arguments about diversity, and this is actually research that a friend of mine at CMU does. And you can't really publish these things unless you can say that, you know, with you know, confidence that these observations are true. My colleague at CMU has done a research project studying how long people stay on teams, and you know, whether their gender makes a difference. And basically, what he found was that software teams that are more diverse tend to be more productive. And to quote the paper, holding other variables or other compounds fixed, teams that are more diverse with respect to gender and or tenure or experience, so mentoring, tend to write code faster than teams that are less diverse. So when you have people who, you know, have less experience and more experience and have, you know, varying genders on a team, they tend to to produce more code faster. And this is a different paper that he wrote, which is also interesting, is that I'm just going to point this out because if you want to read about it, this is the citation here. But it turns out that when you look at how people disengage from open source projects on GitHub, it turns out that people who identify as female tend to disengage faster than people who identify as male. And there's a lot of research on this, which is actually very interesting. It turns out the first thing that people think about is gender, aside from programming skills. They don't even care about people's name, social skills, or what country they're in, but gender is super important to people when they encounter a new developer, which is shocking to me. But anyway, this research project that I just mentioned, which is more of an aside than anything else, basically shows that, you know, in this case, they're talking about social capital, which is, in this case, basically what it means is sort of building camaraderie between people. It's a much more nuanced definition than that, and I encourage you to look at the paper. But what they found was that on teams where people invest in building social capital among the members, you end up keeping prolonged engagement. you keep people engaged longer. Is sort of the TLDR of this research. It's just worth looking at if you care about any of these things. I mean, this is peer-reviewed research, and you know, data that is meaningful. Like, you know, these arguments can be made, you know, with confidence that, you know, they're not terribly wrong. And I guess the point of me just flashing these things up is that, you know, science actually says that diversity, people mentoring each other, makes you build better software. And I'm not just, you know, like, waving my hands and claiming it. A bunch of research claims this. So then back to the main thread of this talk is on the topic of how we build software. So I think that this is not so much of a surprise anymore, but there was a company called Black Duck, which is now Synopsys. They used to run an annual survey asking companies about their open source use. And over the years, you know, the number of people who... A number of companies, they survey thousands of companies, or well, 1,200, 1,300 companies. Over the years, the number of companies that say they use open source software they ran an open source software has increased dramatically. So in 2010, it was 39%, and in 2015, it was 78%, so 2x increase in 5 years. If you keep going, you know, back then, in 2016, companies said that the number one reason why they used open source software was that the quality of the open source software that they were using was better than what you could buy or better than what you could build in-house. They also said that, you know, companies in 2015 had decided to use open source options before proprietary solutions on the order of 2/3 of the companies that were surveyed. So you could say around then, open source kind of became the default choice. 2017, the number of companies that said that they increased their open source usage was 60%. And the main reason at that time was low cost with low vendor lock-in. And so if you look now, so the most recent numbers that I have are from the 2018 survey. And at this point, Synopsys was scanning people's code bases, basically. And they looked at 1,100 commercial code bases and found open source components in 96% of all applications scanned. And they found an average of 250 open source components per application. So that's a lot. 96% of companies used open source by 2018. So that's a large increase from 2010. So over 8 years, basically, you went from one-third of companies depending on open source to basically all of them. This is also a shocking number. In 2017, 36% of code bases was open source components. And by 2018, that number became 57%. So just kind of scanning all of the things that you know make up an open a commercial code base. So, you know, I mean, I blame JavaScript probably, right? Because this is how we distribute packages. But whatever. Point is, you know, this number is increasing. And this is a weird statement to have to make, but many applications that people are building are becoming more open source code than proprietary code, which is weird. So a company called Tidelift is also going around doing surveys and scanning code bases, and so they have similar numbers. So from their research, they can say that around 70% of a business application is open source components. 20% is actually the custom application logic and business logic, and around 10% is commodity infrastructure. So, you know, we're separating Linux basically from this calculation. We're not saying that like Linux is the 70%. So, commodity infrastructure is only 10% of these numbers. So, like, I don't know. Take a minute for like just to think about that for a second. I've been around for probably, I don't know, 10 years in developer land. And when I first started, a lot less of what we were doing was being reused. We were writing things from scratch a lot more than we are now. Now we're doing a lot of piecing together open source components. That's kind of what the job entails more these days. And according to this company called Synopsys, in 2017, I'm going to repeat this number because it's shocking. 36% of code bases of company code base, or sort of proprietary code bases, let's say, whatever, corporate code bases, consisted of open source components. 57%, I'm sorry, I have to say this more clearly. 36% of these corporate code bases are open source components. In 2017, that number increased to 57% in 2018. And according to Tidelift, only 70% of code bases are open source components. And only 20% is actually custom application logic, which is like, I'm just going to keep saying that this is pretty shocking. And I guess this is maybe not a surprise because people have been saying to do this for years. So back in 2011, Mike Krieger, who co-founded Instagram, advised new startup founders to reuse more than build themselves. So he said back then, you know, that you should borrow instead of building whenever possible. There are hundreds of fantastic open source projects that have been built through the hard experience of creating and scaling companies, especially around infrastructure and monitoring, that can save you time and let you focus on actually building out your product. Nadia Eggball, who wrote this pretty timeless report on open source called Roads and Bridges, argued in a blog article that Instagram's $1 billion acquisition, you could argue that about $143 million of it was actually open source components, right? Like you could just take that piece out and say, well, this is due to open source. And yet, according to Tidelift, which is this company that's trying to analyze the use of open source and then help connect people who use open source with their creators, they find that around 60% of the respondents of their open source survey say that they're required to financially support their open source work with their own funds, that they receive no external funding at all. This is 1,200 respondents. Again, this is just people responding on the internet, so I don't know, like, I can't prove to you that this is, like, ground truth, that everybody who, maybe all of Google was not responding to this survey, right? And they have lots of open source components. But still, it's an interesting number. And we all know about terrifying things like, you know, the Heartbleed bug in 2014. So this is just an anecdote that's interesting to note. In 2014, we all know that 2/3 of web servers were using OpenSSL. And back then, there were two guys named Steve. One is Steve Marcus, the other one was Stephen Henson. And basically, Steve Marcus noticed that this other guy, Stephen Henson, was working full-time on OpenSSL. And Marcus was like, well, hey, how do you get paid if you're working full-time? And he learned that Stephen Henson was doing consulting work just here and there and was making only about a fifth of Marcus's salary as a government contractor. And also, it's kind of interesting to note that Marcus had thought he was a good programmer, but he thought that Henson was just, you know, much better, and that Henson had been working at OpenSSL since 1998, so it had been a long time at that point that basically he was somehow scraping by. And Steve Marcus had always assumed that, you know, as had the rest of the world, that the OpenSSL team was large, active, and well-resourced, whereas in reality, OpenSSL wasn't even able to support one person's work, you know, at a reasonable competitive wage. So the point is only that a lot of people aren't aware of these sort of funding issues. So I mean, industry and government especially build on open source components all the time and have no idea that things like this are happening. And I like this one. I'm always going to show this because I love it. So this was a few years back, these numbers when they were produced. But basically, there was a research group in Brazil that came up with a calculation for the truck factor based on how individuals moved logic around in commits on GitHub. And they looked at the 133 most active projects at the time on GitHub and determined the amount of information that was being moved around by specific team members. And they found that 64% of the top 133 projects on GitHub relied on only one or two developers. So the truck factor for those was one or two. And so you're not supposed to read this, but you're just supposed to see the trend here. This is a table that represents all of the repositories with different truck factors. So truck factor one and two are the first two rows. As you can see, that's a lot of repositories. The observation here is that there's only a few repositories that have higher truck numbers or truck factors. And just to choose some that were low truck factors, truck factor one was Grunt, SAS, D3, RxJava, which a lot of people use. Truck factor two was Cassandra, Clojure, Netty, Drupal, and Python Pandas. We all probably use these, right? I mean, I expect a lot of people to use Clojure. We all know who the truck factors are in Clojure, right? I think Scala has like a truck factor of 6 or something. It's not significantly better, but it's slightly better. But the point here is that, you know, there aren't a lot of people who keep these things going, right? And so one thing that I can tell you that I learned from the Scala community, or my time working on Scala, is that sort of the ecosystem and the community are really everything. And since I'm an academic and I like papers, I'm going to throw a random piece of research at you. So there's a paper from 2013 at Uppsala, which is one of the top programming language conferences. And basically, it was an empirical study on the adoption of programming languages. They looked at 10 years of repository metadata on SourceForge, of all places. But, you know, SourceForge had 10 years of data, so that's good. And that's about 500,000 open source projects. And then they surveyed developers with multiple surveys, and they got up to 13,000 responses in some of their surveys. And basically, what they wanted to try and answer was, well, what are the things that are the most important for developer decision-making when selecting a language? And what they found, these sort of like the results that they obtained. So the different bars are different company sizes. The green bar is the overall number, so maybe we can just look at that for a second. And the most important factor overall was the existence of open source libraries. That was the number one most important thing across all of the people who were contacted when making a decision about a language. The next most important thing was being able to extend existing code. And then other things like already used in the group, personal familiarity, team familiarity, performance is in the middle. Tooling is way down here. That's weird. I always thought tooling was much more important. However, according to a lot of developers, all of these other extrinsic factors, like, you know, people knowing things was far more important. And look at that. Simplicity and particular language features are way down here. I guess that's a good news for complicated languages like Scala and Haskell. Woohoo! But the point here is, through multiple surveys, they saw that developers value open source libraries as the dominant factor in choosing a programming language, and social factors that aren't tied to the actual programming language, that aren't tied to, like, fun language features, rate highly. So from that, you might say that an open source project, is its community, or its success is attributed to its community. And that's true for programming languages or just anything in general, that there is a community that's surrounding it and supporting it. I'm obviously not done with Tidelift yet because they have numbers to back this up as well. Basically, in this survey, this professional open source survey that they did in 2018, they found that basically an active community and the fact that something is reliably maintained are the two number one factors that rate as the most important factor in making a decision to use an open source project. Obviously, security as well, but the fact that it's being it's being maintained and that there's an active community, these things are basically coupled, is basically the most important thing. Which, I guess from the 2013 Uppsala paper, maybe it shouldn't surprise me, but it still surprises me. So respondents rated an active community as being over 20% more important than the popularity of a project, which is interesting. I'm just going to put it back to this slide again. The open sources project is actually, in my opinion, based on all these numbers, attributed to its community and the success of its community. An important point that I'd like to make based on that is that community ecosystem are basically, the most important factors to consider, the most important factors to an open source project's success. I showed you a whole bunch of random numbers, right? And you're like, well, how do these things relate and why is it all important? I argue that it was in these three categories, so like, Heather, make your case now, hurry up. The things that I would like you to try to piece together are, first of all, how we build software is changing. Nowadays, we largely glue together open source components. We didn't do this as much even 3 years ago, as much as we do now. So we piece together things that have already been built a lot more than we build things new. There are sustainability issues in open source that we should be aware of and we should do something about as a group of humans that depend on these things. If we're making money off of putting the pieces together, we should probably do something about this, right? Every year, sort of the average, number of years of experience of just practicing software developers seems to go down, which is a reality. Sorry, we have to deal with that somehow. And we need to adapt to it in some way. This is kind of good, right? If we're piecing together open source components rather than having to implement every algorithm that we learned in school. Like, that's nice for more people being newcomers. What does this all mean? As you can see, I keep on pointing out that we're getting newcomers many times so that we don't forget this. And it's also important to note that, in addition to there being a lot of newcomers to our profession, a lot don't have fancy CS degrees. A lot are coming out of these coding boot camps. But then maybe it's also fine that they don't have CS degrees, especially given that frameworks are king nowadays. Being able to make good decisions about what frameworks to use and how to piece things together might be more important. And also debugging things when they go wrong, right? But maybe being an expert at algorithms is less important these days. Given that applications are now only 20% business logic, again, maybe this is fine. We're shifting the experts to the people who build the open source frameworks. And the more novice people might be piecing these things together. Another thing that's actually a really nice point, to like the cheers of the software engineering research community, we're actually obviously getting better at reuse for the first time. Like, we're good at reuse these days. This is evidence of that. And the pieces that we and newcomers are reusing are largely open source now. It's also important to note that I didn't go into detail on the corporate subsidy bit or funding models of open source because, I could, but I don't have infinite time. But the point here is corporate subsidy does help, so that means a company paying somebody to work on an open source project as part of their day job. About half of people who responded to this survey, I know that 49 plus 62 do not add up, but these are different surveys, okay? Please, don't shoot me. This was Tidelift. Tidelift, shoot them. Basically, still 62% of open source projects are self-funded. So this is a problem. It means either we have to shift more of this stuff to being corporately, funded by corporate subsidy, or we have to figure out a new way to actually fund this stuff, because it's only growing in importance. And all of this stuff is related. So it sounds, maybe independently, all of these data points seem unrelated, but this is my argument to how they're related. So we're getting a lot of newcomers across our industry. Applications are becoming a majority of open source components. A lot of gluing together open source framework pieces. And open source continues to struggle with these sustainability issues. So obviously we have to do something about this to better support these newcomers that we're getting, right? Because if random open source projects that people are starting to learn now just randomly die, this is bad for people who are learning, right? But at the same time, all of these open source components being so important and the way that we change, software development is changing, where we're piecing these things together more, it's actually good for this onslaught of new developers that we're going to have to deal with. So, everybody in this room is probably pretty experienced, so you're like, okay, fine, why do I care? So for everybody, that means that we have to kind of think a little bit differently. And I'm going to argue that the most important thing that we all need to think about doing and being better at is becoming good mentors. So as managers, the engineers that you're managing are also going to have to become good mentors. Clearly, you had to become a good mentor if you're a manager in order to be a manager, right? But putting an emphasis on mentorship for your engineers is probably more important now than it is going to be later, because you're going to have to figure out new ways to onboard new and maybe less experienced team members than you've had to in the past. And for people who don't have to manage people right now, mentorship is something that maybe you should consider getting better at. And as educators, people like me, maybe we should be cool with the fact that everybody doesn't necessarily maybe need a CS degree. But maybe we have to figure out ways for them to learn more quickly and affordably so that they can become an application developer, and maybe that's fine. And I'm going to say this one more time. Maybe we should try not to actually forget, or we should try not to forget to actually invest back into open source. I know I keep saying this a million times. But on the mentorship point, there's a nice blog article called Developers Mentoring Other Developers. And basically, what this article points out is that we already have to mentor people. We do that via onboarding practices, and we do that via code reviews. So that's already a start, but mentoring that we should all try to get better at and do more of is more structured and formal mentorship, which takes more time, but provides a lot more opportunities for growth. And the argument is that you can retain engineers better if you can help mentor them and help them move up, right, rather than accelerating this trend of people hopping between companies and, infinitely, right? The only problem is that we don't really have a great way to do this. So far, the only companies that seem to be really good at it tend to be really large tech companies. Or the other opportunity if you're not working at a very large tech company is to try and use one of these online coding communities like Coding Coach. The article, since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to go through all the points in the article, but if you want like a detailed explanation of sort of like a structure that you could follow for doing a more formal kind of mentorship with either engineers in your company or even random open source engineers that would like to just get better, there is a structure for that, and this article goes into more detail about it. And with that, I'm going to hopefully let you escape to get coffee, but I'm happy to answer any questions if we have time for that. Thank you.
have time for two questions.
Two. Okay, yeah. So you and you. Sorry.
Just one remark and a question. You always focus on these computer science graduates.
Yeah.
In my experience, nobody has a computer science degree in section coding. Like in Germany, most people I know code.
Yeah.
They have philosophy degrees, physics,
anything. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know why you
that's
focus
interesting.
Too much on that, yeah.
Well, at least in the US, that's not the case. Most people have software engineering, computer science, information technology degrees. So it's computing related. It's not necessarily computer science. I also know Germany is good at having this like separation also between like applied sciences and you know, fancy universities, right? And so I know that computer science tends to also be more theoretical here than it does in the US. Computer science is a lot more applied. So when I say computer science, I'm kind of, you know, futzing up and using like the American idea, which is, you know, people who build things that are computing related and not necessarily like somebody who does like the theory of computing or something. But at least, you know, in my exposure, you know, even, so I mean, I lived in Switzerland for a long time. Most people that I knew, at least in the Geneva, Lausanne area, they ended up having some kind of computing-related degree, either from an applied sciences school or from a fancy university. So this is just like the data points that I have. I'm actually really excited if there are people with philosophy degrees getting into computing. That's amazing. The US is super bad at this. Recently, they've created a bunch of random master programs for people who have like a degree in biology or something, right, to get, you know, get a master's in computer science, which again is more applied in the US. And that's considered to be super fancy and novel. So if Germany's already good at this, I'm super amazed. That's great. I had no idea. Yeah.
Do you know how the funding situation is for open source programming languages?
The funding situation for open source programming languages is that mostly companies support them. Scala is a weird counterexample because it's partially funded by a company, partially funded by this open source foundation at Fed EPFL that I was involved in. But look at Rust, it's supported by Mozilla. Clojure is supported by Cognitech, I can't say that word properly. Go is obviously Google. I don't know, like just start enumerating them, most of them are supported by companies. JavaScript is developed you know, in a very decentralized way, but people are basically paid to be on these like TC committees, right? These technical whatever committees, and you know that's your job in a company. So even though it's not like one person, one company controlling JavaScript per se, it's people who are basically paid to evolve JavaScript. So corporate subsidy.
Thank you.
Thank you.